Thank you for downloading the African History and Politics Seminar, presented by the University of Oxford's African Studies Center and the History Faculty.
Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be back here, the first time in this building. So it's a nice mixture between returning to the known and seeing new and unfamiliar, also some familiar faces, some new faces, which is always nice. And I'm very much looking forward to the critical discussion that I'm certain will follow. Those of you who were here pretty early saw me fumbling with technology. I had a PowerPoint, but in my experience, I use PowerPoint now all the time in my teaching, but in my experience, it usually contributes very little to content. So I hope you will forgive me that I prepared one, but I left it at home. I just realized I brought the lectures of the last 2 weeks I gave in Vienna, but not what I'm talking about today. So sorry about that. And also, before I get started, I should mention if I'm sniffing a lot, I just realize allergies are coming on again. I do not have a cold, so no fear that I might be contagious. Well, I'm delighted to talk here again, in part also because this gives me an opportunity to return to my earliest research that came up in the context of my doctoral research, something I never expected to work on, female authority, but then also the newest research on Tanzania, where yet again I came across female chiefs. So let's get started. July 1905 in Germany, East Africa, in Matumbi Hills, the rising against colonial authority, the war against outside influence and outside interference with the way of life, with economic activities, with the understanding of the world begins, and from there very quickly spreads south, east, north, southwest. A month later, a young man, Kijala Omari, moves from the Makonde Plateau west to Ngoni, which is the area where I conducted my research. This is where I would have had a map in southwestern Tanzania today. A young man, as I said, from the Makonde Plateau, which means from an ethnic group that was considered to be subservient, potentially to be raided for tribute, potentially even to be enslaved by the politically dominant ethnic group in the southwest, the Ngoni people. He carries the Maji. He carries Maji, the water, the war medicine, and the message that it is time to rise. A young man in his early 20s in a white loincloth, wearing a white belt, and as he reaches Ngoni, it is not clear from the sources. I certainly have not found any new evidence that explains whether he knew beforehand or whether he learned upon arrival that, especially considering his very vulnerable position coming from a subject people approaching the center of power in the entire region of southern Tanzania, wishing to carry this important message, he had to find the appropriate way of approaching central power. So maybe he knew beforehand, maybe he learned upon arrival, but he then knew that the local protocol was to approach not the royal residence first, but to initially approach a royal woman, one of the royal wives. He does that. He approaches Nkumanile, who in the sources, oral sources, as well as written sources of the time, is the term that is used, royal wife, even though it's not quite clear whether she's a member of the royal family or in fact a wife of the, to use the English word, the king, Nkosi of the area. They probably enter a temporary marriage. If they do that, it would be very quick because he leaves his home area in the southeast mid-August of 1905. The war begins in Ngoni, in that area I'm going to talk in particular about in the southwest already during the first days of September. So to convince her that quickly to enter a temporary marriage would be a little surprising. On the other hand, we know certainly that he became her client, she became his patron. He lived at her homestead for that period of time, and then she was convinced to take him to the most senior royal man, Nkosi's brother, who was kind of skeptical. This was a young kid, dressed in this strange way, white loincloth, talking about, and this medicine nobody had heard of. But she persevered, and in the end, she took him to the Ngozi, and thus the story of the Maji-Maji War in Ogoni began. The militarily most contested area during the Maji-Maji War, which, as you probably all know, was quite significant during the German colonial period in what today is Tanzania. And the area of the colony where the war also lasted longest. That is something I talked about last time I was here, which is 5 years ago. It seems almost last century, so I'm not going to go more deeply into this. I want to add two more brief facets in these introductory remarks. So we have Nkomanile, this royal woman, possibly a wife, who plays this incredibly important role as the gatekeeper to newcomers in general who want to approach the center of royal power. In this case, the gatekeeper to the war that began and fundamentally, politically and socially changed the area, something that possibly was not something that could be predicted, but certainly once the polity, the leaders decided to rise, it was a pretty radical decision to do that. Another royal woman in the area was Komandire. In a bit of a debate with Maji-Maji scholars whether these are actually two different women. All my sources say they are two different women. Some of the Maji-Maji scholars say they were the same. I am steadfast in my position. So if you want to fight it out afterwards, I'm up for that debate. A second woman, Komandire, was a female chief. As soon as the war began in the first days of September 1905, she participated in the kind of warfare we saw during Maji-Maji in this area, in Ogoni. There were two major kinds of strategy and tactics employed, and certainly during 1905-1906. The military activities reached all the way into 1908. One was to specifically target political, economic, social enemies. So there were attacks against the colonial administrative center, there were attacks against the mission station, there were attacks against the local coastal slave trader. But the most common military pursuit was to, my argument here would be, to return to a mode of living and livelihood that had existed before colonialism, and that is raiding for economic gain, and in this case to raid caravans and to plunder traders. And this female chief, Komandire, in her immediate area where she had her homestead, an African soldier, an askari, had left his goods with local people to sell them. And one of the first things she did was to appropriate them and say, well, it's war, right? Well, that's off. This is mine now. I'm the ruler of this area, so I take them. The third female I want to mention, I'm going to say a little bit more about her in a while, is another female chief with the name of Nama Bengo. She was the only political leader in this area who did not flee during the war. Everybody else directly militarily participated and or then during the counterinsurgency campaign fled across the border into what today is Mozambique, then Portuguese East Africa, or into other areas. About 2 days before the war began, together with three male chiefs, Nama Bengo, the female chief Nama Bengo, walked to the German district, colonial district headquarters, and she submitted again, this was of course already under colonial rule, to the district officer and said, I pledge allegiance, you know, the four chiefs, three male chiefs, one female chief, they pledge allegiance, but within 2 days, the war begins, and within the very first period of fighting, the three male chiefs join those who were fighting the German colonial authority. And they were executed within a few months. They were caught and executed within a few months. Female chief Nama Bengo is the only one who did not flee, who most likely participated in the fighting. The biggest battle of the entire war was fought immediately in her area with thousands The estimate is about 5,000 Gordi warriors faced the German colonial troops. Right at the center of her political power, it's unlikely that she stood by and did not participate at all. And in fact, sources suggest that at least she provided support, and I'm going to explain a little later that she had her own army as well. And it's very unlikely that she said, oh, my warriors are not going to participate in this. But in any case, she was the only one who just remained, kept kind of low profile through the war, and she survived the war without much harm to herself, whereas the other two women I'd mentioned, Nkomanile and Komandire, were both hanged. The German counterinsurgency campaign was one of the most violent, as you probably know, that you can find within the context of beyond genocide. If you look at German West Africa, today Namibia, you would find probably even worse that happened, but German counterinsurgency campaign was particularly vile and violent in Ogoni. But one of the few rules was you do not execute women, but the German colonial authorities went out of the way to hang these female chiefs for insubordination. So why am I starting with these preliminary remarks? Well, the most obvious point is that from the colonial perspective, these royal women were considered to be sufficiently important to even be executed and to break the few rules that they did exist to curtail colonial violence. So clearly there was significance in their actions, and there was significance recognized even by the colonial state that knew very little about what was going on. But in this case, I would argue, actually got it right. There was certainly a great significance to their role in terms of power and authority within these polities. Second, I briefly introduced three women to you to already throw some light on the fact that we're looking at a whole range of different roles women could have. You know, you have the royal woman who possibly was a wife, certainly a royal woman, who was this intermediary, this gatekeeper, but then you also had some women who were full in their own right chiefs, and I'm going to say more about this. My intention in this paper is to, well, have a stab at a gendered history of power, ethnicity, and kinship, and not merely to do or to contribute to women's history. To make such a contribution is inevitable, though, because there is this great silence about women in positions of authority in East Africa and Southern Africa. We have this huge historiography on West Africa that somehow has come to a standstill again after it got another boost a few years ago, but it's become more silent. But still, I mean, half a library is filled with books and studies on female chiefs, queen mothers, royal women in West Africa, but we have very, very little on Southern Africa and East Africa. And I can assure you, when I was a doctoral student, I said, oh, I found these female chiefs, it's so exciting. People said, no, it can't be, it's not possible. And when I did my research in Tanzania, it was certainly a deja vu. When I interviewed local elders, they said, there were, and I'm going to say more about this in a minute, and I keep saying in a minute, and I have one eye on the watch, I realize I don't have that much time to speak. Local elders said there were two polities, two Nkoni kingdoms, to use an English term, and the elders in one area where I conducted most of my interviews said, well, maybe over there, maybe those would stoop so low to have women in power, but we certainly never had female chiefs. It's completely impossible. And it was towards the very end of my research stay that I did research also on a Benedictine mission station, and the prior said, you've not met the most important person in the area yet. And I thought, ooh, who's that? And he said, well, the archbishop. So he introduced me to the archbishop, somebody with a PhD in history from Rome, and somebody from the area. And I said, just to test this out, I said, isn't it interesting that there were female chiefs in both kingdoms into the colonial period? And both looked at me and chuckled and said, ah, it's very sweet, you know. European woman, Western woman, and of course you want to find your own empowered African women, but women have no say here. Just, and so they were very nice, but you know, they were not too condescending, but they were like, you don't know what you're talking about. And I said, but you know, I have these sources and this and this and this. And the prior said to the archbishop, kind of completely ignoring me, he said, you know, there's the chieftainess up in the hills. And they start talking to each other, and they say, she still distributes land, and she still tries court cases. And this is in a country where chieftaincy was abolished in 1963. Right? And then they agree that, yeah, I really missed out on the most important interview I could have conducted, because there's a female chief in situ, and I did not get around to interview her, because everybody said, oh, if at all, that was in the past and somewhere else. This could have never happened here. So there are these silences, but more importantly, what I want to raise in this paper are questions around power and authority. Yes, I'm looking at elite women, and a lot of critical questions can be raised around that. A preliminary answer to that would be, well, if you look at African historiography, another historiography for that matter, we've learned a lot from looking at extraordinary situations and people. I'm not a big person historian in general, but if you look at how much we've learned about African identities, African everyday life through, for example, looking at court cases, looking at conflict, then yes, we have to say this is not necessarily the rule, this is not the average experience of people, but its sources allow us to glimpse into African society through this gateway, and this is my approach to these African societies through royal women, not to say they are representative for all women, but to just, you know, allow a glimpse into power relations beyond this very elite, little, exceptional group. And the point then is to say that what I hope to show, and I'll see whether I can convince you, that one can understand power in a more complex way if we look at how it is within African society, how it was legitimated through gendered ideologies of kinship and ethnicity. So to use these royal women, to use is a horrible verb in this context, please forgive me, but to approach the topic through these royal women and to look at these gendered ideologies of kinship and ethnicity as they transpire through these women's roles they had in their biographies. And I would like to start with Ongoni and then pull in the Zimbabwean case study, which does not appear in the original title, because I was shy to return to my older research where I started with it. But I will pull it in comparatively as well, and then come to a conclusion. So, more on Ongoni. Just very briefly, as an introduction for those who are not very familiar with southwestern Tanzania, we're talking about two polities that crystallized from the 1860s onwards. Ngoni speakers that had migrated as migrant kingdoms from what today is Natal in northeastern South Africa as part of the so-called Mfikane. The spatially longest migration we see as part of this process all the way from South Africa to Tanzania, and what we know is that some core individuals did actually make the entire journey. So it's a very long drawn-out process of several decades. Of course, many people joined them on the way, but then what we see is that from the 1860s onwards until the arrival of colonialism, we have a process in which these migrant kingdoms that were much characterized by militarization, by warriordom, by sustaining themselves through inviting young men to join them in particular, at times also young women, through being militarily very potent to survive on this long migration until they found an area where they wanted to settle, to then, in this process from the 1860s onwards, to find a way of becoming settled polities, which is very different from being on the move and being able to say, well, every few years we move on and find another area that we either conquer or live in coexistence with. And as part of this process that occurred from the 1860s onwards, when these two polities right next to each other that coexisted peacefully, both Ngoni speakers, both led by Nkosi, with a regiment system, not exactly as we found it around that time, and within the Zulu nation, for example, which might be more familiar, much more loosely organized, a patchwork of power relations where you find different constellations next to each other. So you find some regimental male villages, but you also find tribute areas geographically very close to the heart of the center of power, raiding areas at the geographic periphery of the polities. And Jelu is the name. I'm trying to avoid it because I think it always helps to have a PowerPoint up for this. But Jelu was the name of the southern kingdom, Shopi of the northern one. As I said, Ichet and Kosi, in English maybe king, as their political leader. And their livelihood was in this patchwork of power relations, which was not, you know, a center of power and then in provinces radiating out. It was really different constellations, different ways of relating to the local population, from saying you're a slave raiding ground, you are people where we just ask for tribute in agricultural produce, you are an area where we say, well, if we need more people, we might raid you. So it's, and it, of course, was also in flux. It wasn't just written in stone how this was constituted. And we find that the raiding activities themselves, the livelihood based on raiding for human beings, having the local agricultural labor done by unfree people, slaves, to use the term, and also exporting them into the Indian Ocean slave trade, that was so enshrined in the society that now we have European observers. By 1894, one of the raids, and that was a bigger one, but that went all the way from southwestern Tanzania all the way to the coast, 3,000 warriors set out. And they brought back, according to estimates, and not just German colonial estimates, about 2,000 captives. That's significant, and was in a significant manner the base of economic activity. Now, if we look at Goni ethnicity, and I'm trying to keep this in two sentences, which is always hard because I keep getting carried away, up to revisiting my interest in royal women and female power, I've, the last few years, much more looked into manliness, masculinity among Goni. So I'm just trying to put this into very few sentences. The way Goni ethnicity was defined was either through blood descent or masculinity. So Goni ethnicity was split into, and this is an understanding that interestingly exists until today, into those who were considered to be true Goni, those who are considered to be of men, who are considered to be of direct blood descent from those who migrated all the way from South Africa. They are supposed to be the true Goni. In addition to that, any man in the pre-colonial period could become Goni, not true Goni, just Goni, by proving himself in terms of manliness. The way of doing that would be, even if the status was to be unfree, maybe full slave status or just the status of being a dependent, was to participate in one of the raids and to really distinguish himself, to show bravery, to be very successful in raiding for booty within humans or agricultural produce, whatever it may be, to bring that back. And then there was a ceremony of both a religious ceremony of cleansing, but also a ceremony of presenting the booty to the center of power. And then there was a practice of redistribution of wealth. So the warriors would be returned part of the booty in recognition of what they did. And if an unfree man distinguished himself during these raids and in warfare, he could switch ethnicity from being a subject person to becoming Goni. He could never become true Goni, but he could become Goni. Now, Goni ethnicity is something that is exclusively a male identity. Women can be born through male descent into that identity, but she can never achieve it, and her children will always have the biological, assumed biological father's ethnicity. So in that sense, there can be royal women, but a woman cannot, in her own right, be Goni, and she can certainly not achieve that status. Okay, so let me briefly come back to the issue of female authority in Ngoni, having given that as background. When we look at Ngoni around 1900, so we're looking at the early colonial period, and we can see still into the past, but also get a glimpse into the future. What we see is that in both polities, the Nkosis and the political elite decided that it made sense, in order to have some kind of political control and to have political stability over a relatively large and heterogeneous area, in order to have that control and in order to have that stability, to post royal women, to have them establish their own villages as representatives of central power. These were, and so the sources say, considered to be royal women. They could be royal wives. They could be of royal descent. The idea was that women would more likely show allegiance to central power compared to men. In a society where military power was so important, where individual military leaders could have their own private slave armies as well, potentially a small leader could become a warlord, and we also see that at the turn of the century, that some were considered to be part of the kingdom, were kind of on the verge of sometimes moving into warlordism. So, for example, when they went on a raid with their own soldiers, they would not present the booty to the central power, they would keep it to themselves. And the idea was, if we intersperse these female-led settlements, that would make sure that they would keep an eye kind of on the male-controlled military power, and they would also commandeer all the male and female, and now I'm just using the term slaves, who were supposed to do the agricultural labor, which of course was the backbone also to the entire polity, that agricultural produce could not be obtained just through raiding. It had to be produced within the polity itself as well. For the southern kingdom, Jelu, the estimate is that around 1900, around 70 royal women were distributed throughout the area in four villages, and each village was headed by a royal senior royal wife, so one whose sons were recognized to be potentially the successor of the Nkosi. So you have interspersed between regimental villages, male chiefs. You also have these villages that were led by royal women and who had a relatively large, and there are no clear estimates, I have to do more research on that, but probably, certainly in the hundreds, possibly in the thousands of men and women, slaves who worked for them in the fields. Then what we see is between both polities there were at least six female chiefs. Also at that time. They also had their own slave labor. Their task was to collect tribute. So they were posted not in the heartland, but they were posted in tribute-paying areas. And at least in one case, and I'm going to talk more about the one chief I already mentioned, who managed to kind of play the system so well during the Maji Maji, where the one leader was not executed. Which is quite amazing, or, you know, escape through flight. But it was about control of tribute-paying populations to collect the tribute or tax or whatever you want to call it, to hear court hearings. And sometimes in their own right. Sometimes it was a tiered system where the idea was that the female chiefs, or male chiefs for that matter, would hear kind of the cases in the first instance, and if there was still dispute, it was then referred to a higher authority and eventually to the Nkosi. At least one of them I'm going to talk about had her own male army as well. And so there was, you know, it wasn't a standardized way of thinking about political power, neither was it among male chiefs for that matter. And the standardization, as you all know, occurred during the colonial period. But not at this point of time. There was certainly a range of manifestations of female political power, but they functioned as chiefs as we would understand it. The question of spiritual power is much more complicated, and I can say so much more about Zimbabwe than I can for Tanzania. The only definite bit of evidence I found is that there is always a royal ancestral shrine close to the royal headquarters that is being revered and kept until today. And it's quite surprising. I mean, we have at least one anthropologist here works on Cameroon, so I won't dare, and I don't see the necessity to go into it right now, but to me it seems very unusual that it's a royal wife, and it's the one who's considered to be the most senior wife, who is the keeper of her husband's ancestral shrine. To me that seems very unusual, because, you know, these are exogamous marriages. He would be married only to women who are not of his immediate bloodline, so it's a little unusual, it seems to me, that it's a non-royal woman who's the keeper. But the point is, it's a woman who holds responsibility for the center of spiritual power. But beyond that, so far, I've not found any evidence for female women as ritual experts. As far as one particularly important role spiritual experts had was the cleansing of warriors that I already mentioned before going on raids or war and afterwards. All the sources I've found always mention male experts. Women I've not found, nor in comparative studies for other Ngoni-speaking societies. Now let me say a few sentences about this chief, female chief I already mentioned, Noma Bengo. As I said, 1905, she submits to the Germans and then somehow survives the whole Maji-Maji war. She keeps her office. She's not just not killed, she's also not reprimanded for anything. She was the Nkosi's sister in Jelu, in the southern of the two polities. Sources are pretty clear on this, that she was purposefully chosen not just because of her position within the royal lineage, but because she was strong-willed. And the elders I interviewed, male elders, and now I have to say it is a shame that I messed up with the PowerPoint, which I thought I'd saved on the stick, but it lives on my laptop, which is in Oxford, but not here. Because the male elders I interviewed, one was one of her attendants, I'm going to explain this in a while, when he was a little boy, and the old man, today old man, really say, and she was ugly. She was so ugly. She was tall, and so thin. She did not really even look like a woman. She was so ugly. And she was fierce. She was hot, fierce, really. She burned you. So that's why she was chosen, definitely. This female chief, Noma Bengo, she ruled over the most contested area. Not most contested, that's the wrong word of putting it, but it was east of the two kingdoms on the caravan route. And it was strategically particularly important for a number of reasons, and to just sketch this very briefly, her headquarters was right on the main caravan route in what today is southern Tanzania, which means all the goods went right by her homestead. I mean, I did interviews there, and it's pretty impressive to see. It's very hilly territory, and if you see, it was very clear. I mean, she had 500, the estimate is about 500 warriors in her own right who showed allegiance to her, and to guard this caravan route was very straightforward. So she controlled what happened for both both polities. There was one caravan road coming in from the north as well, from Hanga, but this was the big important one. So she didn't control it just for the kingdoms, but also the coastal slave traders who were located. She was located between the coast and the trade center. She also, once colonial rule was established, she was located between the coast and the colonial headquarters. So basically everybody had to pass her. And if nothing else, she knew what was going on, or her men and women knew what was going on. That was definitely there. That was an important part of why she was located there. The other thing is that Nduna Songea, one of the sub-chiefs and military leaders, he was this main character who at this time, around 1900, had become almost a warlord in his own right. And she was located not right next to him, but in a position where she could, he would send his warriors through, he would have to send them through her territory. So if he was up to nothing good in term, from the perspective of central power, she would at least be able to report to the Nkosi of what was going on. So definitely in a very important position there. She collected, as I already said, that was typical, a tribute from the local population. She actually maintained the caravan route, and the sources are not, you know, I think they are, you know, I believe them, but I would like to see more evidence on this. But there is, there are suggestions that she actually used forced labor on the caravan route before colonial rule. So that was nothing new when the district officer said, you have to maintain that, that road, because she had already put people there, that road had to be maintained. Part of her authority, she was a ruler in her own right, certainly. And in a way, one can ask, well, what would be the difference between her and a male chief? You know, she was powerful, she had her sword. Yeah, there were male chiefs like that as well. One big difference is that she frequently humiliated and symbolically humiliated her subject population. And that is something I want to argue in this paper you find with female rulers, but something that was not an integral part of male authority. Now, whether that was at times also up to the character of the individual person who held a position, that is something I think is, will be impossible to establish now, certainly not for that time period. But let me explain and also add a little bit of a caveat. You know, this I get to through interviews. So we're dealing with historical memory and the difficulty, how do people remember this today? I'm aware of that. And you know, of course, in the discussion, I see how critical you are of this kind of material. So from the interviews, what I found, and these are interviews with male elders, I should add, from her area, the way her homestead was set up, that she was always surrounded by attendants, prepubescent boys and girls, 10 boys, 10 girls. It's kind of like a hostage system you find in other African societies as well, in this case from the subject people. They were supposed to sleep with her. In the interviews, the elder said it was to protect her from sexual assault, to keep her safe, because she was a female ruler. But the point was that, you know, this was her court. She didn't just have a warrior, she also had these children with her. She drank heavily, and she drank hard alcohol, alcohol that was considered to be by status. It wasn't just gendered, but also by status. Those who had more political authority could drink harder alcohol. More, what's the word? Alcohol, higher percentage, I don't know how you say this. In any language for that matter. In the interviews it's pretty clear, and if you also look at the colonial sources, and I'll get to this in a minute, that she, at least, you know, from the colonial sources when she was older, but also from as a young woman, she pretty much was drunk most of the time, it seems. And one of the, when I talk about humiliation, when she was younger, when she had her children, she always had attendants, and in the interviews the men are very precise, one can take that each way one wants to. She had, apparently always had two attendants, so when she was too drunk to breastfeed her children, they were supposed to, you know, take one of her breasts and make sure that the children would be suckled. And often, you know, this was apparently not gender specific, but often the male attendants would do that. But whether they were male or female, to have to do this for her as she lay there passed out, and I can assure you the interviews were very descriptive and very, you know, she was just passed out most of the time, it seems. That was part of it. And I'm with one eye on the watch, I'm going to get to a comparative account also from Zimbabwe, which I think is very interesting, that part of the humiliation is body politics when it comes to female power, and in this case about breastfeeding, to having have the attendants, to have a female chief. Of course, we all have seen, you know, in secondary literature and our own research, these stories from the early colonial period, all the colonial accounts, you know, district commissioners being so frustrated, all these chiefs always drunk, the male chiefs. But here is another aspect to it. Here we have the corporate reality, the body regime, the humiliation that's imposed. You are subject people. I can be as passed out as I want to be, but you still have to take care of this. Another aspect that one elder, who as a little boy was her attendant, when she was an old woman already, he was positively foaming at his mouth when he told me that whenever she went to the bathroom, the female attendants had to actually wipe her after she defecated. And everybody was talking about this. You know, how dare she? You know, this is something you do in absolute privacy. You will not, you do not do this in the presence of others and to humiliate children into having to wipe you with a maize. He was very, and he said, and, you know, they had to prepare the maize cobs and the sun. And he really wanted to perform this for me. He wanted to perform the humiliation. And he said, he was so horrible. A third aspect of the humiliation was that female chiefs controlled. If they were, and it seems that the female chiefs, the ones who ruled in their own right, were not considered to be royal wives, but royal women. In this case, she was a, Noma Bengal was a sister of Kosi, the king in Jebu. But they controlled male sexuality. Now, we're all familiar with these arguments about that before colonialism, in many African societies, and during colonialism, of course, as well, the control, male control over female sexuality in terms of biological reproduction was so important. And how we find in the codification of customary law that adultery became one of the most punishable offenses. And that usually male elders, when they were interviewed, when customary law was codified, said, well, what was the penalty for? Well, of course, the death penalty. Adultery is the worst. Here we find that the inversion of it, that female chiefs actually have the right to control male subject sexuality. In the case of Ongoni, I was told that, and this is exclusively from interviews, that and specifically in the case of Noma Bengo, she would actually call upon her male sub-chiefs and she would say, when I have a child, you get me that young man over there, you get him to me to visit me tonight. So she very directly did not just appropriate individual male sexuality, but she could, in that sense, commandeered, she controlled male sexuality among the subject population. And finally, just a brief... from one interview with an elder about her, the one who was had been a child attendant when he was little. The ethnic group over whom she ruled are the Wandendeule. He said, they called all of us Wandendeule their Watumba, as slaves. She never did anything. No farming, no weeding, no cooking. And he really wanted to emphasize, and you know, she's not a woman. She didn't do any, you know, she didn't do housework, she didn't do, according to gender division of labor, she didn't do any of the agricultural work. It wasn't just she didn't do anything, but she, and she really, really, and anybody, I didn't do a lot of interviews, but the interviews I did, it was as if it had happened yesterday. To finish the story of Noma Bengo in particular, she was finally deposed in 1921 just after the British had taken over colonial rule in what then was Tanganyika, had just become Tanganyika. The Germans had been exasperated with her. The British were exasperated with her, and they just about had it. She never did what they wanted. You know, they would ask her to do one thing, you know, provide labor for something, or you know, come to a meeting at the district headquarters, and you know, she might show up, but usually not. Or if she showed up, she was drunk, and they just found her insufferable. And so she got several court convictions in the brief period. I mean, de facto, not by mandated by the League of Nations, but de facto through military conquest during World War I, the British had already taken over the area in 1916. But still, it's a very short period for the British colonial administrators to be so exasperated with one female chief. But she'd already had several court convictions, illegal brewing of beer, and you know, all the usual things we see in colonial sources. In 1921, they finally deposed her. They finally had it because to use the language of the sources, the colonial sources. She was pimping the local women to the local Askari camp for a fine fee from the British commander to keep the African soldiers amused. And I only have a colonial source, but you can imagine that the subject people, you know, they thought we are moving towards, they didn't know Narek War would come soon, but they had thought that the Maji Maji War would be an opportunity to get rid of those nasty Ngoni people who would treat them badly, and then there's a new colonial power and they're still subjugated, and this woman, she would pimp their young women. So they were glad to be rid of her. So, in a few sentences, yes, in Ogoni, women had power too. It wasn't just those warriors, you know, and we all know, of course, the images of Zulu, and I'm more familiar with that probably than Southwestern Tanzania, but it's very similar. And today in popular culture in Tanzania, the Ngoni dances are still they're still the most sexual, and they're still supposed to be the most masculine and manly. We see much more than that. We see a range of political offices and roles. We see that both polities, both kingdoms, kept control over the majority subject people in a range of different ways. One was, and I want to come back to what I said earlier in my introductory remarks to Ngoni, and I think it's important, through allowing aspirations for men, to say any man in that area, even a slave, could become Ngoni and could thus become part of the politically powerful ethnic group. But at the same time, women were very much used as a control mechanism within the administration. And part of that was not just to have them kind of interspersed with other political office holders to report back to the Ngoni, to show allegiance because they were women, but also to signify humiliation towards the subject population, to really keep them in place and say, I can do this to you because you are less. And I can put you into full slavery anytime I want because I have, you know, I am here in my own right. A few remarks, if you allow me, in comparison. Of course, I'm much more prepared, but I'll stick to the time I'm told. Number six?
Six, yeah.
Okay, I'll stick to it. Okay, and I'll just point out similarities and differences. This is where the whole story began, where I started to become interested in female power when I did my doctoral research in eastern Zimbabwe, so I'm taking you somewhere else, eastern Zimbabwe. A polity called Mutasa became centralized in the 17th century. And then in the late 19th century, you have further political centralization under one particular ruler. They're called Mambo, under the pressure of other African polities. And in the east, in Portuguese East Africa, the Portuguese had arrived. They started to negotiate, fearing that the British would, you know, who would come fast, scramble, all of that. We know the story. But in any case, there were external reasons to solidify the power within the polity. Part of that was to establish political offices for women. And what we see, and again we look at the same time period around 1900, what do we see there when we look at, and I'm taking again the step back into women's history before I gender it, I took a step into women's history, we see that in, and here I can be very clear about this, the other sources are there, and the evidence is there. Around 1900, most spiritual authorities, in particular senior spirit mediums, were women. So when we look at power and authority in Mutasa in eastern Zimbabwe, political power and spiritual religious authority go hand in hand very, very strongly. Here I'm already kind of pointing towards a difference that I'm coming back to in a minute. And the second kind of snapshot, what are we looking at in 1900? The second aspect is similar, like in Ngoni, we see female chiefs who are chiefs in their own right. Out of, in the polity, out of about 40 chieftaincies, a quarter, so about 10 were held by women. So when we quickly look at the similarities, what do we see? And I'm going to focus on the female chiefs and then bring into it the discussion of spiritual authority as well. Definitely the hope for political allegiance, the hope that women would be much less likely to show allegiance to the central power. And the argument always was a woman could rise to a truly elevated position of power, but she could never become in Ngoni Nkosi, in Mutasa, Mambo, so she could never become a ruler of the entire area. That would not be possible. So she would always keep her allegiance to the ruler. Second, similar to Ngoni, where women, royal women, were probably often posted in order to keep in check the military power here as well, as part of this consolidation of the kingdom, the ruler posted, in this case, warrior chiefs, and it's quite clear that often he put a female ruler at his side to make sure that there was a royal woman next to him, and you have the dual power that reminds us, or me at least, a lot. I don't want to use the word nurses, we, you know, the injection won't hurt us, so I don't know what you find, but I find it reminds me of some of the institutions we see also in West Africa. We have those dual power structures. We know, for example, Dahomey. You also find in Mutasa the control over subject male sexuality. Here, however, the idea was that the biological father was not supposed to be known. So the female chief was supposed to have children. Her children were considered to be of the royal lineage, so they inherited her totem. And in order for that to be very clear cut, the biological father was not supposed to be known, but she could basically just choose any male, subject male, to her pleasure. And an interview I did with a current chief at the time when I did my research, there was a process of restoring female chiefs, which the Zimbabwean state had no clue of, especially the local administration didn't know what was going on, which was very interesting. One female chief had ruled for a very long time, actually. She told me, to the great displeasure of the present male sub-chiefs ruled underneath her and beside her, she said that when she was young, she would just, you know, watch the pretty herd boys when they were herding back her cattle in the evening, and then she would just look which one she wanted that night and choose. So this control over male sexuality. Also, here also at the forefront of anti-colonial resistance, we can extend that back into the pre-colonial period. So, you know, the women I'd mentioned at the very beginning in Ngoni during Maji Maji, here I could give examples as well of female chiefs being very resistant, very outspoken towards the colonial administration, humiliation as well, and just to kind of give a different take from the male hurt pride that I was certainly part of the interviews I conducted in Tanzania. Here I have a Victorian account from the early 1890s. The three first white women who lived in the larger area, the three British nurses, who met one of the female chiefs, Nyakukwanikwa. I misspelled her, so I have to insert another W. Spell it right, sorry. There we are. Nyakukwanikwa. Who visited the nurses, and to their great shock, they wanted to have tea. You know, what do you do when you meet another woman? You have tea, high tea. And the female chief said, well, can I have something stronger? Which shocked the nurses greatly. And then they said, she accepted tea, passing her mug after drinking to the two men who sat behind her. These were two of her husbands. We were told that she had several whom she divorced or knocked on the head as seemed most convenient. Well, yeah, I mean, that's a Victorian view. They also describe how, you know, the men were just handing her babies. She had, you know, always several who were at an age where they needed to be breastfed. So the men were approaching her on their knees, subjugating themselves. But these were not her husbands, they were her warriors. And the nurses were just baffled, how can that be? So very quickly differences, and I have my blog. Differences. Here we see female chiefs, royal women, always, never wives. In Mutasa, I didn't see that at all. The wives did not play an important role. A big important difference that I'm not going to get into for time reasons, whereas in Ongoni it seems that if not always, at least often, women were on purpose chosen as adult women in their own right, like Namabengo, that ugly woman with a bit of a will. Here they were prepubescent girls. That's very different. And here in Ongoni I made an argument, I hope, about ethnicity, that you have this duality between female figures in authority to guarantee central authority, but also this ethnicity playing this tremendously important role to allow men this, at least this hope, this aspiration of changing their role, their identity. Here it was about kinship as a marker of difference. And in the area where women ruled, all the subject people were considered to be of son-in-law lineage, a Nehanda lineage. So structurally, they were supposed to be inferior. And it was expressed in kinship terms, that as fictive as kinship can be, there's nothing you can change about it. You know, you can move away, you can go somewhere else, but as long as you're there, you will always be the son-in-law, and you will never be the father-in-law. You come out of that. Other than the kinship terminology, other than the age of the women when they gained power, a lot of similarities as well that we see, and I'm more than happy to fill in more. I realize I raced through that, through this comparative dimension to my paper, if you're interested during the discussion. In conclusion then, if you look at the historiography on ethnicity, and I want to end the paper on that note, which is something I was kind of challenged to write about for the ASA, USA last year, and an angle I hadn't taken on my material on female authority at all. If you look at the historiography on ethnicity, what you see is that the creation of tribes during the colonial era, there's very much the emphasis on Mahmud Mamdani's decentralized despots. They are male. There's an emphasis on political authority, on political and male office holders. If you look at the post-colonial era, even the pre-colonial era, at times, you find the emphasis lies with political tribalism, something as Africanists we kind of have to respond to in political terms. But whatever time period we look at, there really is the prerogative of the political. And my suggestion is, what happens if we look at moral ethnicity rather than political tribalism? What happens if we look at political ethnicity? What happens if we look at the meaning of ethnic identity within communities, and connect that with an understanding of power in terms of gender and a gendered approach? What a gendered approach adds is, as I already said, well, clearly women could do it too. No, it's not something that just happened in West Africa. It happened in Southern and East Africa as well. And I would go as far as saying, yes, I only have two case studies, but I would be surprised. I keep joking about my research and saying, wherever I look, I will find female chiefs. Mm-hmm. The more people tell me I'm wrong, the more I'm convinced they were there. It's just that you have to look more closely. These are societies where people very firmly told me there's no way, it's not possible, but they are there. And I'm not saying they have to be universal, but it's a common phenomenon. But when we look at the gendered discourses and practices of power, we really get at the heart of the legitimacy of power within African societies. You know, the question of how did African societies stabilize central power? I think that in order to answer that, it is really important to look at gender, and it can at times be about maleness. And in the Ongoni case, it is a lot about masculinity, about that route that was open to become Ongoni, but it is also about gendered practices, for example, of humiliation, that in this case was enacted by female chiefs, and gendered practices of power that, yes, at times stabilized simply the central power. We don't need to assume that women necessarily were there to resist or to contest male hegemony. So, finally, final sentence, women in positions of authority can be truly subversive, I would say. One example is that female chief I learned about on my final day of research on my fieldwork site, who still, you know, chief justice of 1962 and still holds court cases. Well, I'm not sure she's still alive, but held a few years ago. And she flew under the radar of attention because everybody said that there can't be female chiefs. You know, why is it that there were no male chiefs in the entire area, but she could still get away with it? And the restoration of female chieftaincy in Zimbabwe in the 1990s, that nobody even noticed. You know, local administration, district administrator, provincial administrator had no clue that that was going on. And I think that's part of the story of gender and power, to see that women are, for better or worse, they tend to be more invisible. And there's a lot more to be found out about them. So thank you very much.